Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. This is the podcast for February 14th, 2009. This is a very special podcast because this week marks the 200th birthday of Charles Darwin, and we're coming to you from the AAAS annual meeting in Chicago, Illinois, where the festivities are well underway. I kind of feel like we should have like party hats or noisemakers or something like that.
And it's not only Darwin's birth week. This year also marks the 150th anniversary of the publication of his book On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection.
So to celebrate, we've got a bunch of stories for you about evolution and natural selection. We'll tell you why evolution and globalization together can make for a deadly combination.
And we'll meet a scientist who studies bird courtship using robots.
And we'll tell you how love-struck mosquitoes woo each other. But speaking of love, it's also Valentine's Day. Suzanne, what does this holiday have to do with evolution?
A lot more than you might think, Bob. If you have a sweetie, surely you've shared a kiss or two on Valentine's Day. But have you ever stopped to wonder in between smooches why we kiss?
No, not particularly.
Well, you weren't thinking of that? Well, neuroscientist Wendy Hill of Lafayette College has, and she says it's likely that kissing evolved in the great apes from a primitive behavior called pre-mastication.
What? You can't say that on the radio.
This isn't the radio podcast.
Oh, okay then.
This romantic act involves chewing up food and then transferring it to one's baby through mouth-to-mouth contact.
And in many ways, it very closely resembles what we might call a French kiss in terms of the oral stimulation, the influence of saliva being transferred, and so forth.
She says kissing probably evolved from this behavior because it helped strengthen the pair bond and led to greater reproductive success.
This behavior helps to solidify the pair bond just the way that the mother-infant bond is solidified through contact. We think kissing plays a strong role here as well. And so those pairs that engage in kissing would have a higher reproductive success as a result of that pair bond.
She says kissing not only releases the love hormone oxytocin, it also moderates our levels of the stress hormone cortisol in the body, and that keeps us healthy.
So get out there and get kissing, folks, and cortisol, oxytocin, that's all just so romantic.
I'll say.
And while we're in the mood, Justin Warner has a heartwarming and harmonious love story for us.
Most operas and musicals feature at least one love duet with male and female voices converging in harmony. Scientists are learning that mosquitoes do something very similar during courtship, and that these duets may prove the male mosquito's mettle. Cornell University entomologists Laura Harrington and Lauren Cater explain that male and female mosquitoes' wings normally beat at very different frequencies. Here's a male alone. And here's a female. These may sound like pure notes, but they actually contain several layers of higher tones called overtones, which harmonize so well that they don't stick out. During courtship, the mosquitoes synchronize their wing beats and match certain high-frequency overtones. Cater says the result sounds like two instruments tuning to one another.
You can actually hear those overtones sync together. If we fly pairs of males together or pairs of females together, this behavior doesn't occur.
So what's the point of these duets? No one knows for sure, but Harrington says it may be a kind of audition for mating. She explains that males hang out in swarms, advertising themselves for females that flit in and out of the area. It takes a lot of energy to both hover and join in the duets when opportunity strikes.
And so we think that perhaps females are using this as an assessment tool to determine if the male is fit enough. She wants to maximize her fitness by mating with the fittest male around her.
If that proves to be the case, scientists could use this to their advantage. They say that if scientists could genetically engineer mosquitoes that perform well but don't cause disease, these mosquitoes could then be used to introduce disease-proof genes into the general mosquito population.
Thanks, Justin. Well, mosquitoes don't have a monopoly in romantic communication. Take these sage grouse, for instance. Males mate with many different females, so they're really not all that picky about what the female of the moment looks like. In fact, they'll even mate with a robot that resembles a female of the species. Animal behaviorist Gail Petroselli of the University of California, Davis, took advantage of this lack of fussiness to get a behind-the-scenes look at their mating behavior. She teamed up with engineers to create female sage-grouse robots.
With a robotic female, I can basically manipulate one side of the conversation and see how the other side responds. So I can have the female bird do a particular behavior and then see how the male responds. And that helps me understand, first of all, what the female is saying with her behavior, but also I can compare males and how they respond, how responsive are they to the robot, and try to understand if that relates to their success in convincing real females to mate. So the robotic sage grouse, in addition to allowing me to perform these controlled experiments, also has an onboard microphone and an onboard video camera. So in addition to manipulating the behavior, I can also literally get inside the head of a female on the breeding ground watching a male's courtship behavior and see what she sees and hear what she hears. And in the sage grouse in particular, that's very important because the male signal sounds very different depending on where you are as a listener. And so getting inside of a female's head and hearing what she actually hears will help us to understand which males are more successful in courtship and what females are looking for in their potential mates.
She says that just as in human courtship, individual male sage grouse exhibit large differences in social skills, which determine whether females will ultimately choose to mate with them. Next, Suzanne's going to switch gears and take a look back at the not-so-healthy history of the human diet.
If you think the modern American diet is bad for us, it might give you comfort to know that humans have been making unhealthful food choices since long before the advent of fast food joints.
It's argued that many of the chronic degenerative diseases that we face relate to a discordance between what we eat today and what our ancestors evolved to eat.
That's paleoanthropologist Peter Unger of the University of Arkansas.
We tend to have a very narrow, restricted diet. The average American eats mostly processed carbohydrates, processed flour, fats in the form of cheese, and occasionally we throw a little bit of tomato sauce on top. And having this narrow diet has led to some serious chronic problems that have been associated with it.
He says it may sound counterintuitive, but after the dawn of agriculture, our health declined.
Once the narrowing of our diet began with the origins of agriculture and the domestication of animals, we saw a real slip in health. The average stature, which is a good indication of nutritional quality, drops dramatically. We start to get metabolic diseases that can be related to deficiencies in key nutrients. We start to see tooth cavities coming up, crowding of the teeth.
All due, he says, to a decrease in variety and an increased reliance on carbohydrates like wheat or maize.
It's not a very good thing when we dramatically reduce the range of foods that we consume.
This way of eating persists in our modern diet. What can we do about it? Eat plenty of fruits and vegetables, stay away from the center aisles of the supermarket where the processed foods lurk, and eat a healthy variety of foods.
Thanks, Suzanne. Our final evolution story today concerns emerging global infections. SARS, HIV, West Nile virus, all of these diseases migrated from relatively isolated regions to areas where conditions allowed them to spread and evolve much more easily.
Something which is present in one location may no longer be restricted to that location. Instead of, you know, being restricted to a small jungle or, you know, or forested area in Southeast Asia or in Africa, it's now moved out into the human population.
And there's evidence that emerging diseases are spreading around the globe faster than at any other time in human history. This according to Ian Lipkin, an epidemiologist at Columbia University. He says increased international travel and trade have made this possible.
But there are other factors, too. We have a population which is increasingly susceptible to infectious agents because many of the things that we use in modern medicine result in impairment of the immune system. So people who get transplanted, whether with organs or with blood or with stem cells, or we have people who are simply living longer who don't have immune systems that are as strong as younger people. Those are all examples of how you wind up with a population that's more sensitive. So it may look like new microorganisms are evolving and becoming a problem for us, but in fact, what it really may mean in some instances is just that. Because our culture is evolving and our trade is evolving and the nature of our population is changing, that we're beginning to see agents that have been there all the time but simply weren't present in the context where we could recognize them.
He says scientists track the spread of such diseases using mathematical models, which may help them predict and prevent future outbreaks.
The most important emerging threat is the one that may not even be here yet, because if you look back over the past decade, there have been literally tens of new agents that have appeared. That doesn't mean that they weren't there before. It simply means that we didn't necessarily know that they were there. The first thing that we try to do is we try to model by looking backward and figuring out what factors were important in the emergence of a new disease, which diseases will likely be important problems in the future. So there have been people who have been modeling what are known as hotspots of infectious disease emergence around the world. And there are a number of factors that are considered, such as changes in climate, the proximity of humans and animals that might otherwise not come into contact, very dense populations which provide opportunities for spread, and of course, intersections with national travel and international travel so that once something gets into the human population, it can quickly move across the globe.
Well, that's our show for this week. Next week, we've got more stories about evolution for you. Charles Darwin thought a great deal about the evolution of human social behavior, and we'll look at the very origins of our conscience and our morality. Until then, check out our Science Update Podcast Daily Edition. We've got a fascinating new science story every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website, scienceupdate.com, or at iTunes. Or if you're on the go, you can also listen by calling 1-512-499-2149. That's 1-512-499-2149. And if you have a science question you'd like to hear answered on the show, give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.